Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back at Perimeter. I haven't been here in a while. I'll talk, like Davide says, about flavor-specific dark sectors, concentrating on scalar mediators. This is work that came out last year and still in progress with Brian Battelle, Iris Freitas, and Dave McKean, all of whom are or were at Pittsburgh at some point. Okay, so as a preview, let me tell you what I mean. I mean, by dark sectors, I just mean some new standard model singlet particles. They're motivated, right, by a lot hints of new physics or questions in the standard model, right? We don't know what dark matter is. We don't know what generates neutrino masses. There's G minus two floating around. Maybe you like that.
It's proton radius off, though, right?
Yeah, it's very good. So now there's reason to bring in new particles, a lot of different interesting reasons, and of course you can put in scalars, which I'm going to talk about today. You can put in vectors, you can put in fermions. If you put in new, if you gauge something new, like you add a new vector, you have to be careful about what you're gauging. It's not that you can't do it. Of course, you can also put in new fermions, and people have talked a lot about those. Today, I'm most interested in what you can do with new light scalars. And of course, the downside, right, of new light scalars is one downside is historically that their masses get quantum corrections. But I'm going to take the viewpoint that based both on examples in nature and in the political sphere, maybe big hierarchies between things and people are just a fact of life, and that's how our world is. So with that in mind, let me tell you what I want to do today. So I'm going to talk about what I motivating like dark sectors and why it might be interesting to have a scalar that, in particular, preferentially couples to one flavor of fermion. So that's going to be the sort of the main thrust of the talk. Those kinds of theories historically have you have to be careful with their flavor issues. So I'm going to talk about how you can have a scalar that talks specifically to one kind of one flavor of fermion. And still avoids a lot of the flavor bounds that typically plague such theories. And then I'll give some phenomenological examples for a scalar that likes to talk to up quarks and also sort of motivated by G minus two. I'll talk a bit about a muon philic dark scalar as well. So, like I said, there are a lot of different motivations for light scalars or light new stuff. Here's one example, right? I'll just review it. So we know here that the dark matter exists. I remind you of the canonical Wimp paradigm, which tells you that for a roughly weak scale cross section and mass, you get about the right amount of dark matter that we observed today. On this standard Wimp scenario, there are upper and lower limits on the mass, right? So if your Wimp is too heavy, then it doesn't annihilate enough, and you get too much dark matter still. But if you just have a weak scale cross section and you're too light, then you still have a problem, and so you can't really go below the GeV scale. So if you want to have lighter dark matter, then you would need some stronger or something that annihilates you more than G Fermi, than the weak interaction. Okay. At the same time. Light dark matter is in some ways maybe a bit less constrained, right? So this is the standard direct detection plot off the Cosmic Visions report from last year, and I'll remind you that in today's halo, dark matter is moving at around 10 to the minus 3 times the speed of light, so this is its rough momentum, and then typically what these traditional direct detection experiments are looking for is for dark matter to come in and make a nucleus recoil, and so. Depending on how low you can go in your detection threshold, you can hopefully see these recoils. But as you get lighter and lighter, the thresholds get harder and harder to. It gets harder and harder to be above threshold. So your limits get worse and worse and worse, and in particular below the GeV scalar. So there's very relatively few limits. And over the past few years, there have been a lot of interesting developments in experiments and proposals seeking to access this region. And so that's another, perhaps, motivation to think about these light-dark sectors. Okay. Good. So that's one motivation to think about new light particles. It's not the only one. And if you do buy this, then you should ask what sort of ways can I couple a new dark sector to us? And there are three standard dimension four portals interactions that we have. These are the vector scalar and fermion portals. So here you're imagining a dark photon that kinetically mixes in the simplest case with our U1 EM, and that's sort of the one standard picture that people often constrain. Another one is just a new scalar that interacts with the Higgs portal, and that's again something that you know now the Higgs mixes and the scalar recovers all the couplings of the Higgses essentially. And then finally, there's also you can add a new fermion, right? Sort of like a sterile neutrino, and then it couples through LH. Okay, and these are the dimension four portals that you can write down, and they're relatively predictive. And so that's sort of a blessing and a curse, as I'll describe, I guess. So the idea here is now that presumably you have some new mediator that talks to us, and then this might talk to your dark matter or whatever else there is, right? And so. Regardless of what else this mediator might couple to, what I'm going to focus on today is searches for the mediator itself. So here again are the different portals that people often think about. And as a very broad one slide overview of the sort of experimental or phenomenological goals, right? We want to produce it, and we typically start with some standard model thing, and we use a portal coupling. Here's the scalar portal. You just use the mixing with the Higgs, and then you look for this decay somehow, right? And so if you go to standard model stuff, that's great. If you think that there's more in the dark sector, so if you're motivated by dark matter, maybe this decays invisibly. For the rest of the talk, I'll kind of be agnostic about exactly what more is in the dark sector, but. You know, sort of this consideration will be to some extent on my mind, right? Whether this thing decays visibly or invisibly. I want to point out though that you know if this sort of matters because if you sort of independently of the dark matter motivation I've sketched, this production and this decay is totally independent, right? So that's the idea is just you have a dark sector, it's got to have a mediator. You can look for that mediator. Here's an example of one of these portals, and again, there are only a few of them. Here there's a dark photon again. It kinetically mixes with some small mixing epsilon. And what happens is this photon acquires couplings to all the standard model particles that are basically the same as their charge down by epsilon, right? So on this axis, it's the mass of the dark photon against effectively the mixing strength epsilon, and there are constraints from a wide host of experiments. Trying to describe even more than two of these, I'll just say that broadly speaking, at larger couplings, at larger interaction strengths, you're directly producing these dark photons, and they decay relatively promptly. Here you're producing at LHCb these dark photons, and they're going to dimuons, and you're looking for that. On the other hand, at relatively low couplings, and this is a log plot, I have emphasized, you can probe these dark photons even if they have a relatively long lifetime. So here, because epsilon is so small, the mixing is so small, they're living a relatively long time. So of course, it's non-trivial to produce them, but then you can actually see their decay products at a very displaced detector. So these are proton and electron fixed target experiments. So the idea is you smash a beam into some target, then you have a lot of shielding, and then way downstream you have a detector where you're looking for them to decay somehow. Okay. The thing about these experiments and the way this plot is drawn is that everything is sort of fixed by this parameter epsilon and the mass, right? I mean, it means that. While some of these constraints come from The quark coupling, some of them come from the lepton coupling. There's some, this is really fixing everything. And this is good in the sense that it's predictive, but it also means that there, you could ask, is there more out there, right? So you can ask, how can you go beyond these kinds of universal couplings, right? So, in the case of this vector mediator, for instance, right, you could say, well, maybe instead of having just some simple kinetic mixing, maybe you can do something where you have this be the vector boson of some curve, right? So you can make this gauge B minus L or L mu minus L tau or something, or you can even do something more exotic and do something that's not anomaly free, but then you have to be a little more careful. There are other constraints. Anyway, you can ask the same question for the other portals as well. So I use the dark photon as an example of one. Now I want to switch gears and talk about scalars because they'll be the focus of the rest of my talk. So so here's another example then of what happens in the case of a scalar portal. So I remind you again, this is just some new particle S that acquires the couplings of the Higgs through this mixing S squared H squared. And roughly speaking, what's shown here is a similar or analogous mixing parameter against the mass of the scalar or a dark matter that talks to it. If you could imagine that since the scalar is mixing with the Higgs, that its dominant coupling is to the top quark. And so a lot of the most powerful constraints on this plot are coming from diagrams involving the top coupling to the scalar. So this is an example of a rare meson decay. So this is like a B decay or a K to pi decay that's going through a penguin diagram, right? So in this example, this is invisibly decaying, so it's like B decay plus invisible. And these are providing very, very stringent bounds. And in particular, on this plot where they have a target for where dark matter is produced just through thermal freeze-out through this interaction, it really damages the line by several orders of magnitude, right? So these decays are clearly very constraining. As you can see in this simple scalar portal, you know, with these parameters, admittedly, these kinds of couplings make you have very tight constraints. So we wanted to ask the question: what happens if you didn't have this kind of if you didn't have this kind of setup, right? So what if you had a new scalar that had no effective coupling at top quark? Sort of in analogy with the stories about these vectors that don't maybe couple to quarks and leptons proportionately to their charge, right? And this is something that hasn't been thought about as much, and we sought to answer this question. So you can imagine, right? If you don't have this, say you just coupled to up quarks, right? Then because here you have an up quark mass, and here this would be a lot harder to be constrained. Okay. So that's the setup in a nutshell. So you know, to summarize how the start here, you know, you. I'm interested in these light mediators between us and dark sector, and possibly new novel sectors that are singlets under the standard model. You know, you produce them, you decay them. That's how you see them. And the simplest portals are very predictive, which is good, but it also means that there's a lot more space that we should explore, especially in an era now with a lot of new experiments coming online. Okay. Are there any questions so far?
It's M chi over M phi there.
Oh, so here it's the dark matter mass, but it's so there because there are a few parameters here. So the scalar, the new scalar and the dark matter particle in this plot are fixed. So it's true that there's in the most minimal case, if I just have a scalar and a with some interaction strength, those are only two parameters. Then if I say, okay, well now I think that it also talks to dark matter, then I have to say, well, how heavy is the dark matter? And so it's a standard thing to make different versions of these plots. So here the scalar is decaying to the dark matter, and you can ask how these plots change but for different ratios. You know, basically you make two versions of these plots, one where the scalar can decay to the dark matter and one where it can't. And you'll see examples of both of them soon. Okay, good. So let me try to tell you more about how you would build a theory where a scalar talks to a specific fermion and what the considerations are. Okay, so I don't want to just reproduce the dark Higgs story, so I'm going to necessarily have to go beyond. The immediate price I'm going to end up paying is to lose my full renormalizability. So in other words, if I want to couple a new scalar directly to quarks, SU2 invariants suggest immediately that I have effectively a Higgs here, right? And this is as we'll see, right? One of the reasons why typically you say that the scalar couplings go with the mass, right? Because you're morally going as the Higgs. You're morally mixing with the Higgs. So these are basically the two operators you could write down, coupling a scalar to quarks directly. Well, directly meaning through this dimension 5 effective operator. One of these is a derivative coupling, and one of them is not. You can go in from one to the other with field redefinitions. So I'm going to, without much apology after this, sort of concentrate on this one. But effectively, there are different. Once you say you have this operator, you should ask, okay, well, how does it? What are its effects? And then, should I care about the UV completion? And I won't talk about the UV completion much unless somebody really wants to know. But I'll say that most of the things I'm going to say here are independent of precisely what the UV completion is. In a nutshell, the standard two ways to complete this are with some vector-like fermions or with some additional scalars.
Make that completion as far as you want. Can you dial? Are there constraints as to how far away you can get?
So let me go on a few slides and let me tell you some constraints that involve the where that cutoff is. Yeah. So you could imagine, for instance, asking, you know, like I said, right? There's this hierarchy, right? So there's a standard hierarchy problem. So you could, I mean, one thing you could, for instance, ask is there a correction to the scalar mass that come from this interaction? At some point, you know, at the scale of that effective theory, they're eventually completed and something else happens. But do the corrections to the scalar mass make sense up to that scale at least? So you could at least ask that, for instance, right? And that will put a constraint, for instance, on some relation between the size of that coupling and that cutoff scale. So we'll get there. So I'll consider this operator. I'll consider it in specifically with as a 3x3 matrix, right? In this generation space. So generically, if you have just arbitrary and anarchic flavor structure here, you easily get flavor changing neutral currents, and that's bad. These are highly constrained, right? So the standard way we get around this is to impose a symmetry like minimal flavor a hypothesis like minimal flavor violation. We remember that if you take the Yukawas out of the standard model, that you have a very large flavor symmetry. So you can go between up charm and top and so on. And that's U3 to the fifth. And minimal flavor violation is just a hypothesis that your standard model Yukawas are the only source of the breaking of the symmetry. What that means is that if you have any new interactions, then you can put flavor indices on these. You can ask through spurion analysis what the charge of the representation is of this coupling under the flavor group, and you can say, okay, well, what kinds of structure flavor structures can it have in terms of these Yukawas? Because the Yukawas are the only things that can give you non-trivial flavor structure. Not surprisingly, because this looks a lot like the up Yukawa with the singlet on top, the leading kind of coupling you would write here is just that this coupling is proportional to the up Yukawa. Okay, and that's the standard scenario. And of course, you could write down then at next order other corrections that involve the up and the down Yukawas that still give you the same symmetry, the same representation under the U3 of the fifth. And we'll see that shortly. But people try to go beyond minimal flavor violation and preserve the flavor phenomenology of the theory, and that is often the challenge in these kinds of setups. And what I'll try to describe here. So minimal flavor violation is again this assumption that the new physics preserves the full flavor symmetry, or if you're just thinking about the quark sector, the U3 cubed. You can imagine with the top being so heavy, maybe the new flavor, new physics couple is only the third generation, which is really close to the Yukawa, the up flavor quark Yukawas, right? So it's not actually too much of a perturbation, but you can understand it from a symmetry perspective too, right? You say, well, the new physics, if it only couples with the third generation, that instead of respecting a full U3, it respects a U2 symmetry, right? Generically, right, the flavor-changing effects, so for instance, meson mixing, are proportional to basically the misalignment between the Yukawa matrices, the standard model Yukawas, and the interaction basis of the new physics. So let me put this out there to say that if you have new physics that couples, if you're in your CS, you have in this 3x3 matrix, it's a rank 1 matrix, and you couple to one single combination of the quarks, you will still preserve most of your flavor symmetry. And that's basically the story. Okay? So I haven't even told you whether you're coupling to the up mass eigenstate, the char mass eigenstate, the top mass eigenstate, or some combination of them. I'm just saying that if you just couple to one eigenstate, you're preserving a lot of the symmetry. And that's going to be somewhat helpful. Okay. So what I'm going to do is say I have such a coupling that maybe is that has only one non-trivial entry in some basis, and then I'm going to very quickly tell you what I think that basis.
Always put this up quark mass term, right? There are other things that you can put down quark as well.
Ah, okay.
Just to stay away from. Can and be mixing?
Good. So, yeah. So what I'm going to say is that these, if I write this down, I certainly induce the other one, right? I certainly induce a down quark at some level. So I'll tell you what that is. But you could also ask, why do I not put them both like at the beginning?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you can. It's I don't know. At some point, it's a bit of a question of how much you want your new physics to be. Align. There's no reason I don't think you can do it. It's just that you need to align. You're going to end up having to align two of these layer matrices. I don't think there's any strong. There won't be any strong barrier. It's just going to end up being that you have to align two things. So very soon I'm going to see that you're going to have to align this at this high scale. But then you're going to see that it's technically natural. And that's going to be the. And then so if you do that in the up sector and the down sector, this is fine. You can just put them on top of each other. What I'm going to do here, though, is just start with this one and say, okay, this is an operator I have. This is an operator I have. It's just a scalar mass. I'm going to ask what kind of other couplings do I get if I think these are the leading couplings. What else do I get? So in particular, I should ask in the down type sector, what do I get? What do I get at higher order that changes flavor? And I'll think a little bit about the scalar potential too. And what I hope to show you is that when you put in these couplings and you start with this aligned such that it doesn't make you have any flavor violation, then even when you throw in other when you throw in everything you possibly can that respects the same symmetries, that you end up not generating a large amount of flavor chain neutral currents, and that's going to be the physics.
And then things like SH squared and S squared H squared, are those there as well?
Or? So I'm gonna start with the assumption that you have these, and then I'm gonna show you precisely the size of S squared H squared, and I'm gonna ask that it not represent an enormous correction of the scalar mass.
You're gonna demand that those things get generated from these ones?
Or? I'm gonna start with the assumption that you start with these, and then I'm gonna that with only these, and then I'm gonna say. If you started with those, if you had some theory that gave you those, what is the reasonable size of the rest of the coupling? So you know, it's saying that you know, I don't want to arbitrarily set that everything else to zero and ignore them when they could be significant. I'm gonna say maybe they if they come from these, how big can they be? Yeah, that's gonna be the idea. Okay. So like I said, suppose you just have basically one non-zero entry here in this coupling, and you're to at tree level, right? The orientation of this in the quark mass eigenbasis determines the flavor chain neutral currents. So as an example, right? If I'm working in the quark mass eigenbasis, so up charm top, and I couple and I have like a order one number in an off diagonal element, generically I get huge bounds from d meson mixes. This is a meson with a charm quark. So because that's so devastating, I'm going to start with the assumption, this is the dirtiest thing perhaps that you'll hear this hour, that your coupling starts out being aligned with not the flavor basis, but the mass eigenbasis. Okay? And for the purposes of most of the talk, I'm gonna just say that if you start with this, what can you get? I'm gonna concentrate more on the relative flavor innocence that ensues. But if you want, afterwards I can tell you a story about how you might start to go in the direction of making this happen. So what does this coupling do? Well, it takes the U3Q cross U3U, the flavor symmetries of the left and right-handed up quarks, essentially, and it breaks it down to two U2s, right, in this bottom part. And it breaks the one chiral symmetry, right? It breaks the chiral symmetry of the up quark here. And it leaves you with, I guess, the phasing, the overall phasing of the up quark mass. So this is saying that the assumption here, the alignment that I'm starting out with, is that this is aligned with the up quark Yukawa. That the symmetry that this is breaking is exactly the same as the symmetry the up quark Yukawa is breaking. Okay. So I want to be upfront that I'm not going to do anything super magic here. But starting with that. I'm going to show you that it doesn't lead to devastating flavor corrections as you would otherwise actually expect. Okay. So now, if you take this as your starting point for the theory, then all your flavor violation ends up having to go as the down quark Yukawa. It's easy to see, right? Because in this basis, in the mass eigenbasis for the up quarks, the standard model up Yukawas are diagonal. This new physics is diagonal. So all you can do that breaks flavor is the down type Yukawa. Okay, and of course in this basis it's just CKM times some diagonal matrix. Okay, so you can ask from a spurion perspective again, what is the first correction to this SQHU coupling that does not have to be fully diagonal, right? Based on the symmetries, what can you possibly write down that is flavor violating? Okay, and it turns out that it's this. Okay, so in other words, you can see why roughly by thinking about the flavor and shift symmetries that I told you about before. So in particular, there's a symmetry where S is shifting that's broken only by CS. So if you have this coupling. This operator, then CS better be there. Like I said, the tree level version of this coupling is just CS, but then the next order, which has flavor violation, has to involve one Y down at least. Then, since it involves since Y down by itself breaks the down quark chiral symmetry, you better have two of them, and that's effectively what goes into estimating the size of this correction.
So, with the shift symmetry, why didn't MH break it?
MS. Ah, good. Yeah. So good. So you can say you can also say MS breaks it, right? And then maybe you have to be a little more okay. So then you can also say there's also, I guess, maybe I was blasé. There's a Z2, right, under which that MS does not break, that CS does. Yeah, that's the better way to say it.
It's a kind of solid breaking, good, because it doesn't generate any vertices, right? Yes. Yes, there's always an issue of whether if you break the symmetry, right, like whether this is proliferates or it stays in the mass sector.
But it depends on what the rules are, right? And then that's part of the danger of not writing everything down to the potential you could have written down, right?
So let me see. So you're saying, I mean, so I've written down MS squared, right?
What's nice is that you're phrasing it as a symmetry statement, right? And so
right.
The symmetry that you're using. It was a Z2 symmetry for
right.
Sorry, it's S, I guess.
S, yeah.
And then there's, you said there's also a shift symmetry?
Well, yeah, you can, well, if you think, the shift symmetry may not be, I said it, but it may not be the best way to understand this particular operator, actually, because in principle, that symmetry is broken by both of these, whereas if you think about the Z2, it's really only broken by this one.
Right.
I should have said it that way. Yeah, no, I apologize.
All you wanted to argue is why there was a CS there.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, no, but you're absolutely right, I think, yeah. Very good. Okay, and so in particular, I've tried to argue that there should be not only the CS there, but also the down-u kawas. And precisely because the down-u kawas are small, if you just couple this to the up quark at first, the size of this is actually quite small. You know, even neglecting whether this is maybe generated with the loop, I mean that's not a big deal. Already, that you can see that if you plug this into to make your d-meson mixing and ask how big this is, it turns out that this is not actually that very constraining. And that's sort of the gain here, that you started with something that was not totally minimally flavor violating, and you still have some residual symmetry that's pretty reasonable and allows you to evade a lot of these flavor bounds. So that's the game. So because I talked about the first flavor violating term in the expansion in the up quark sector, I'll do the same for the down quark sector. So again, you can estimate the size of these. They end up going like this. There's a down u kawa. And I'll say that there's a you can think of these diagrams or this operator is coming from these two diagrams. One of these is sort of flavor diagonal or conserving. One of these is more flavor violating. If this is where am I? If the down type yukawa has got to be there. And so they both go though as an up yukawa and a down yukawa and your new coupling. If you end up computing them and these contribute to k-on mixing, then they tend to not be as constraining as just the d-meson constraints I showed on the last slide, which ended up not being important in turn. And it's again just because the symmetries enforced that you had to have not just the new physics couplings, but also light quark yukawas. So that's the power of the symmetry arguments. Okay. So I wrote down sort of the flavor violating couplings. Now I want to talk about the scalar potential itself briefly. And here there's not going to be grand statements, because we know that usually the usual statement is right that scalars suffer from hierarchy problems. I'm going to take the view that because I've got some effective operator here, that at the scale of that effective operator, new physics comes in and fix things. You know, maybe there's Suzy. I don't know. But I'm just going to say that if I want my effective theory that I wrote down to be valid up to the scale m, let me naively estimate the size of the scalar mass correction by cutting off this diagram at that scale and ask what correction is induced to the scalar mass. Okay, if that correction is more than the scalar mass itself. In some sense, you can think of the theory as tuned even just in this effective description, right? This is not sort of, as we know from Higgs physics, this is not like a hard line or anything. It's just it's a criterion which you could imagine using as a guideline if this is to your taste. Okay? If you do that and estimate the size of the coupling, this sort of gives you a rough estimate of how big you should imagine this coupling being. And so to answer the earlier question, if you think that that you want this theory to be good up to a very, very high scale, you can have that if you want, but the price you pay is that your scalar mass is, at least in this region I'm imagining, is probably going to be relatively tuned. And so, you know, you should expect that it looks funny, right? I mean, if your perspective is that the Higgs looks funny, then that's fine. If you want it to be more natural, then you should think about this. So this will be a line on the plot later. And
it also depends a little bit of how you UV complete this stuff.
Yeah.
So when you try to evaluate, the UV behavior Or if you complete it via vector-like quarks where the heavy, where S couples directly non-derivatively, then it's not going to be two diagonals.
Right, yeah, that's right, yeah. So this is one example where going to the two and actual UV completion makes a difference, right? So if I go to a completion, like a typical vector-like quark completion, this is now like, it changes by half a loop factor. There's a 4 pi. That's right. Okay, and then you can do the same thing with the S squared H squared, and this ends up being less important if the cutoff is above sort of the Higgs VEV or the electroweak scale basically, but it sort of gives you a parameter for how much you should worry about the S squared H squared term, which is the usual mixing that I've imagined here is not leading. Okay, so let me now talk about the other s to the n terms, not just s squared, and this will be the last one I do. So in conjunction with the new physics coupling, the standard model Yukawa induces an s VEV right away, and this is naively it can be not small, and so you should ask, is this an issue? Just writing it down, and I'll say that the main one way of asking if this is an issue is to say, well, you have this coupling, just this new coupling that couples the scalar to up quarks. If you give the scalar a VEV, does it cause a bad correction of the up quark mass, right? And you can find that. And of course, it there's still a chiral symmetry, but because this cutoff might be, you might worry about whether this cutoff is large. You can say, oh, well, that tells you something about how big the overall size should be. And it ends up giving you the same bound as just the requiring that the scalar mass itself not be 2. So this is, so sort of however you parse it, you get this sort of expectation, if you want, or criterion for not wanting this coupling to be too large. So this gives you, if you want, a target to think about. Okay, so the point here is that as opposed to just saying as soon as you break minimal flavor violation you're done, there are a lot of things you can do that preserve a lot of the residual symmetries if you just have one coupling, one chiral symmetry that you break. And I'm saying that if you start with an initially aligned coupling in the quark mass eigenbasis, that your flavor physics ends up being pretty darn reasonable, I would argue, because of the symmetry principles. They go proportionally to not only the new coupling but also the quarky couples. Okay, so that's the so yeah, and then that things change a little bit depending on the different UV completions, and you have but you you know if you require that things look good up to the scale where that UV completion comes in. Also gives you a target on how big your coupling is. Okay. Are there any questions about this? Okay. Okay. Let me then tell you, based on say you've made such a theory, what you can do with it, sort of at that might be useful to experimentalists. Okay, so I'll talk about two examples. I've talked a lot about a scalar that prefers to talk to up quarks as a big contrast to the usual scalar that prefers to talk to top quarks. So I'll spend a bit of time talking about that, and then time permitting, I'll talk briefly about what happens in the lepton sector if a scalar talks to muons. Okay, so imagine you take this coupling, and from here on in, I'll basically talk about the dimensionless coupling of the scalar to up quarks. If you think that this scalar should mediate interaction between us and dark matter, you could also imagine coupling it to some chiral dark matter fermion chi. Okay, I've argued how this is constrained, how the size of this is constrained, there's a naturalness type criterion. There's no such analogous constraint on the dark matter coupling that's this independent. And so I'm imagining without being too specific, that that this coupling can be relatively sizable. I mean, and so either I'm imagining this is either allowed or it's not allowed. And that is to say, this decay is either allowed or not allowed just by kinematics. If this decay is allowed, I'm imagining that this coupling is sizable enough compared to this one that the scalar always decays invisibly. And if just to write down some, have a concrete setting for my phenomenology. Otherwise, I'm imagining that the scalar only decays to standard model particles. Okay. So now just building up the setup for the searches that I told you about at the beginning. Let me talk about how the scalar decays if it can't go to dark matter. Well, if it's more than a few GeV, you just imagine it decaying to up quarks and then those hadronize, and that's fine. If it gets very light, the threshold that you really care about is the pion threshold. Because once you can't decay to pions, then you have to go through a loop to photons. And we estimate that using the constituent quark mass. But since it's a loop decay, just know that it can be relatively long-lived and that it has phenomenological consequences. You start to be able to look for it at these sort of beam dump type experiments where you're looking for something way deep downstream.
I think you can calculate it exactly. There were like in the early 90s papers by Lightweiler and Schiffman on how to treat, say, Higgs, say, like 10 MeV or something like that. What's the decay rate to photons is, right? You can add rest.
You mean using the quark the effective quark masses inside, or you mean differently?
Oh, having an exact, I mean,
from the
some sort of low energy theorem type.
Right.
So you can you don't have to say, oh, I have a constituent quark of that mass inside my pile.
But can he? Because he doesn't mix. The Higgs was special because it was coupling to this.
Yeah.
You can probably scale the couplings, right? So for instance, for in the intermediate regime, I do something similar. So in other words, people say, you know, if you have these couplings of a Higgs-like scalar to different quarks, how do you know how much it couples to? You use these the trace of the anomaly to write down effective form factors that are palatable to the gluon the trace of the stress energy tensor, which I haven't shown here, or the up and down quarks or the strange quarks, and you get three different form factors. And if you just couple the up quark, this is the only one I care about. But this is what I end up using sort of in the few hundred MeV range. Possibly I could do the same at low. You're saying I could do the same at low, to the effective coupling of photons, maybe.
Well, Higgs, it's known that you can do it, but maybe.
Right.
But I think the standard model of Higgs is special because it's the one that's breaking scale.
It might very well be.
So yeah, I mean, it may be worth thinking about more I can say that to get these other expressions in the intermediate regime, I am going from the case of a Higgs and scaling appropriately, and that I think is I think accepted by people like Donahue and so on, who wrote out these originally. Okay, good. But
so you're arguing you can use those arguments.
I thinking I might be able to. I mean, I'm not. I'd have to think about it to be sure, but I guess. But I mean, quite possibly. For what I'm going to show you, it's not going to make a huge because these are going to be log plots. But yeah, it's possible. Yeah. Good. Okay. So same story for dark matter annihilation. If you're heavy enough, there's just some standard calculation. If you're sub GeV, there's some form factor. The form factor comes from pion and kaon scattering data, taking into account scalar resonances that are hundreds of MeV. So it's like the sigma, a few hundred MeV, but it's very broad. So it has sort of broad effects over the GeV 100 GeV down to sub GeV range. These are just I'm imagining that these couplings are both real, by the way, here. And that means that, that this annihilation is P-wave. It avoids CMB constraints for light dark matter. I won't talk about it as much because it's a little more open from a parameter space perspective. But if the dark matter can annihilate straight to the mediator in the secluded annihilation case, that can also happen. Then this annihilation is independent of the up coupling. Okay. You just have chi-chi to SS. Okay. So let me tell you about a few bounds on this theory. Okay. So if the scalar is light, that is light enough that it can only decay to photons, you should be careful about whether it's in thermal equilibrium during BBN. So if it's light enough and it's in thermal equilibrium, then there are two effects basically. It's light, so if it's relativistic, then this contributes to an effective naively. But also, if it decays to photons, that sort of directly changes how many photons you have relative to your baryons, right? So these end up moving in opposite directions, and if you're and the net effect is that if you're very light, that your scalar decays increase the effective baryon to photon ratio at the start of BBN, and this in turn ends up depleting your deuterium abundance, which you know is no. So there's two sort of broadly speaking there are sort of two regimes in which this matters. One is when the scalar is very light, and then it's just very bad because it's sort of in equilibrium way too long. If it's heavier, such that it decouples before, it can still be okay, but it can also not be okay depending on how long it really takes to decay to photons. Because if you get late decays of photons, that can still mess things up. And so that's, I think, the shape here. And you'll see it on the plot later. There's basically, at heavier scalar masses, sort of over 20 MeV or so, there's a line showing that it has to decay fast enough. Okay. The other constraints you get are from terrestrial experiments. So you produce mesons, and then they decay between themselves. I'm producing the scalar, which can then go either to photons or to pions or what have you. So here I'm imagining looking for different kinds of decays, beta k, k to pi, and so on. And to emphasize, there's a difference with the standard Higgs-like scalar case, where again everything was coupling through this top, because again there's no real top coupling at tree level, or even through one mixing. You have some very very loop suppressed coupling, and it doesn't matter to basically a good approximation. Instead, the meson decays that end up mattering most are the ones with sort of light flavor quarks in them, and which makes sense, right? Because this is a scalar that talks to the up quark more. So given that these mesons can decay to scalars with some non-trivial branching fraction, I'll tell you how we make an estimate of it. We just use the chiral Lagrangian, and we say, okay, let's write it down. Let's expand it to the first to sort of to leading order in the derivatives, and just say, well, okay, there's some spurion here. It's got not only representing the scalar couplings. It's got now not just like in the standard model the quark masses, but it's also got our new scalar involved. And because this interaction here leads to not only scalar meson-meson interactions, but also through these quark masses, the actual meson masses, we know roughly how big this is. And so then, you know, going from the meson masses, we can extract we can estimate the scalar couplings to meson. So this gives you couplings between the s pi, the s pi and eta, so this tells you like the eta to pi s decay, and so on. You can do the same, and you know, down here you can do the same for k on decays. Okay, and so we don't claim that this is sort of perfect, especially at high for heavier scalars, but it gives you an estimate of the branching ratio, which we think is roughly reasonable. Okay, so what can you do if you have these decays, and I'll tell you that this is one of the biggest ones. There are two things you can do. You can either look for precision on these zetas, or you can just make a bunch of them like at a beam dump and ask what can happen. So here, there's a missing target here. Here's a schematic of a proton beam dump experiment. Proton comes in, hits a target, and then it makes a spray of stuff that then gets stopped. Because the proton comes in and it's coming in at some high energy, you effectively get a scalar beam that comes through. And it's very weakly interacting. And again, you just put a bunch of shielding here, and you hope that downstream, the scalar finally decays to photons. Of course, whether it does that depends on the scalar lifetime, and so there's some window, right? If the coupling is too big, the scalar decays back here. If the coupling is too small, you don't get enough produced in the first place. Okay, so there's some standard window where this is reasonable. That's an example. I'll show you a limit from CHARM, which used the SPS beam, which was 400 GeV, and looked about half a kilometer downstream for axion-like particles, and that search was recast. The other thing you can do is, like I said, doing sort of more calm precision measurements of these mesons. So this is a plot showing some Dalitz plot parameters in e to the 3 pi decays. This is essentially asking sort of the invariant mass of two of the pions in this decay. And so if you imagine that there's some resonance here, you want to look for some band. And the fact that you don't see it lets you put a limit in the appropriate mass range on a scalar that could be a resonance in this decay. Okay. I want to say that sort of the last slide and this slide talk about the case where the scalar goes to photons and pions. If the scalar decays invisibly, it's actually, I couldn't find a search that's currently done, but there's going to be an upcoming facility called Red Top at Fermilab that will make a lot of ETAs, and it might be an interesting thing to search for there. And
we're optimistic as to whether it's going to be happening, this Red Top.
You're very optimistic or not?
I'm not at all.
Okay. I don't know. I thought they seemed pretty positive, but I don't know. I don't know. Certainly the number, I forget exactly how many they would make, but it sounded like it would be very useful, I don't know, for this kind of thing at least. They have a lot of different, I guess, decays they're looking for, but they didn't mention that one, so it seemed worth pointing out. Even though I've talked about a coupling that a scalar that prefers to talk to up quarks, I want to emphasize that, I mean, it's got this loop coupling to photons, and so even if you have an electron beam dump experiment, you can still look for them. So for instance, at the E137 experiment in Slack, you could do basically the same thing. And these limits are actually pretty reasonable as well, even though you're only going through this loop coupling to photons. Let me just flash the summary here. Showing the everything, all the curves I told you about, and then some. There's basically a sort of a critical point here at the pion threshold. This is where MS is 2m pi. Below that, you decay to photons, and you're relatively long-lived. And this region is actually constrained pretty well. Above that, you're less constrained. Once you get above a few hundred GeV or so, direct detection bounds come in, and these are this is a combination of, I guess, crest, CD mass, and eventually xenon that end up going pretty far down. The statement here is that I've drawn a thermal dark matter target to guide your eye, and it's actually only still viable in a small region. However, there's some movement that you can put in here depending on what you assume the dark matter mass is relative to the scalar mass, but also upcoming direct detection experiments. So in particular, there are lots of different proposals, but this is a line from the upcoming NewsG experiment at Snow Lab. We'll push way down. So the gain here is that you're using some light gas, right? You're using methane or neon or something.
Here the mass of the dark matter is slightly larger than the mediator, quite large.
Oh, good. So here the your scalar is I believe it's a third of your dark matter. They're within a factor of a few. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I should have written that. And the dark matter coupling is order one. I'm assuming. That's it. Okay. Let me say. Yeah. Okay. Good. So let me say briefly then. That was the case where the scalar decays visibly. If it decays invisibly, you can get not only sort of meson decays like before, where now your scalar goes invisible, so k to pi nu nu, which is something that NA62, for instance, is looking for. The other thing you can do is in these beamed up experiments, you can make your mediator, and here this is a minimum plot that shows a dark photon because that's what they were looking for. But you can just as easily make a scalar in a meson decay of the kind I've told you about. It goes to dark matter. The dark matter comes way down, and then it hits these big large volume neutrino detectors. And then you look for that scattering to happen. Okay, so that's another search you can do, and that's interesting. It depends on the dark matter coupling as well, of course. Finally, if you have some thing that decays invisibly, you can just make it at the LHC, and you can use some initial state radiation of a jet to produce a monojet event. So a jet recoiling against missing energy, and you can search for that sort of somewhat independently of what the dark matter does. And so here, there's sort of more space at the lower end. And in particular, to answer the same question as was asked on the previous plot, here the scalar is a few times, it's three times the dark matter mass, so it can decay. And so that mini-boon line I showed, I mentioned from the dark matter beam coming in and hitting the neutrino detector is here. K to pi nu nu is here, and then direct detection eventually comes, leaving some region that you know is again going to be probed by future direct detection bounds. Okay. And a lot of the lines from before were gone when you were decaying to visible mesons, or to visible final states. Okay, I'll briefly say then that you can I've talked a lot about the upvillic case. I hope I've convinced you this is sort of a more general setup that you can apply to different fermion-specific setups. So in particular, you can ask about a muon-Fillick scalar sort of motivated by G minus 2, and sort of the difference between this and a usual regular scalar or even a leptophilic scalar is that if the scalar drops below the muon threshold, below 2 times the muon mass, it can't decay right away. Because normally, if you're a regular scalar, you go to electrons. But here, you can just you just go through a loop to photons. You're generically pretty long-lived. So what that means, right, is that if you're long-lived, you could imagine a few of the different proposals that. You can imagine looking at the proton and electron beam up experiments that I mentioned for the upvillic case. But you can also look at these muon beam experiments that people here have thought about. And so the general idea is not that far away from the electron and proton beam ups. Again, you have a muon hitting a muon beam hitting a fixed target, and then depending on the configuration, either you're looking to measure the muon. And hopefully you see some missing momentum so that if the scalar went right through the detector, you can still see the effect just by looking at the muon recoil, or again, just looking for the decay products of the scalar that are produced. Okay. And then again, there are proton and electron beam dump signatures. If you're muon philic, you actually produce a proton beam dump through kaons, which decay to mu nu s. As opposed to these e to the pi s decays for the upvillic scalar. I'll skip that, and I'll just say that sort of this is what the plot looks like for a muon philic scalar. So you have this is again just the muon coupling against the scalar mass, and this line is sort of the muon threshold, and you see that below that threshold you're again pretty well constrained. This band shows the region that would explain G minus 2. This upper region shows the region where you over-explain it. In particular, at higher mass, it's interesting because there's open space right now, but there's open space that will then be covered by two different kinds of sort of more high energy experiments. So this is a line from Z decaying to 4 mu, so Z to mu mu scalar, and then the scalar goes to mu mu. And this is like sort of the current LHC bound, and this dashed line that's cutting in is the high luminosity projection. And then this is Bell, or this is Babar production of that scalar, and then this is what Bell could do. So you know, there's interesting places where you could then go with the setup in this case. All right. So that's basically it. You know, I've tried to argue for a generalization of the usual minimal flavor violation hypothesis that allows you to have a new scalar that couples a new fermion to a specific fermion, sort of motivated by the desire to explore sort of more general dark sectors and ask about how much these standard scenarios can change. So in particular, the rare meson decays that are often so constraining for regular Higgs-like scalars end up giving way to other interesting light flavor meson decays and beam dump experiment bounds. And this is a general framework that doesn't just work for your favorite fermion, but can work for anything. So I showed a couple different examples, and I think exploring these sectors is perhaps an interesting thing to think about for the future. So thank you very much.
Other questions? Edwin, you basically mentioned it at the beginning. The so you start from the assumption that in the mass second basis you're just a coupling from the U quark. If there was a term like CU, that would be constrained to be 10 to minus 5, more or less, with respect to the other one, or even worse. That would be already a three-level flavor change in neutral currents.
You mean? Oh, you mean if I had an off-diagonal element?
Exactly.
Yeah. It's well constrained. It's
philosophy of what you like.
Yeah. So it's
exactly zero, but what would be the
constraint? Yeah. It's so in that example, it was like this. It's so soft-diagonal element is constrained to be very, very small, like 1/10 to the 8 GeV or something. Like the dimension folds. So effectively, if you're asking, you know, what is the dimensionless coupling that's equivalent to that, it's like, what, 10 to the minus 6 or something, right? Depending on where the mass is, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but you can get these. Yeah, okay, so I didn't talk about it, but one can talk about how one can arrange these setups in higher theories so that you can not be as surprised. I mean, the weakness here is in some sense that you're, you know, you ask how can you get this alignment, and the answer is there are UV theories where that you know kind of elegantly give you these kinds of structures from and what people do is they write down sort of a bunch of fields like this, a bunch of fields that are flavon-like fields, and they write down the most general potential. And in a relatively broad, under relatively broad assumptions, these end up being aligned. So either aligned in this way or sort of or universal, and that can be shown.
What you threatened to tell us about those models? Is it easy to say how that works?
So, okay. So I will just parrot what somebody else wrote to do this. And so, in a sense, the goal here for them, the goal was, you know, can we separate out flavor and the hierarchy? So they said, okay, let's assume that you have these flavons, these lambdas, and say they have a parity symmetry. So that's what they're imposing. They're imposing they're imposing a parity symmetry, and then they ask, what is the most general potential you can write down with all of these flavons? When you write this down, there are these coefficients. They claim the most general potential you can write with these flavons. And if the coefficients are positive, I want to say all of them, then you can show that the vacuum ends up having each of these be rank one and aligned, which is, and it's a mathematical statement, but then it ends up being very useful, right? So then what you do is, this sort of is what explains the, if you want, explains the it sort of separates out the standard model mixing the whatever CK makes CKM from the hierarchy between the masses. And then what you do is you say, okay, let's, in addition to that to those up charm and top flavons, add one more, which represents the new physics, and you say, okay, well, now that these are in 3x3 flavor space, but you have four of these flavons now, so one has to be non-trivial, or one has to be sort of, it can't be independent. So then, you know, it's not foolproof, right? I mean, but they say if you have some generic structure of these coefficients, it's not unreasonable to say that you end up getting a VEV for this flavon that's aligned with the rest of the Yukawas, either in like this sort of a very specific one, like a 100, or a universal, like a diagonal 111. That's the statement is in here that they say if you take these couplings sort of arranged in this way, it's not ridiculous to think about being aligned. That's maybe a better explanation than just saying you start out that way.
And let's thank Ahmed again.
Yes. Much bigger means like 10, or does it have to be?
Oh, good. So yeah, so then it depends on how aligned you want it, I guess, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So what happens here? So this coupling ends up being positive, this one's negative, and these are smaller.
How aligned did you need to be?
Okay, so this depends to some extent on where I am in the, if I want to be, well, okay, so like Davide was asking, if I want to be aligned with the up quark, I better be really careful with the charm quark because of D-meson mixing bounds. And that sort of constrains me at the 1 over 10 to the 8 GeV level for the dimension full coupling, dimension 5 coupling.
That sounds like at the level of dimensionless numbers, it's like a part in 10 to the 5.